UK Wine Show, show number 162. New York Wines with Jim Treesize. G'day, my name's Chris Scott and welcome to the UK Wine Show. It's show number 162 for the 25th of June 2009. Well, the weather's great. Well, it was until Friday with Wimbledon on, and my tayberry bush at the back of the garden's supplying me with fresh berries every day, so life doesn't get much better. On this week's show, we're exploring the New York wine region. We talk with Jim Treesize, the president of the New York Wine and Grape Foundation, and we talk to Jim about New York grapes, climate, and the wine styles they make. In the spotlight, we're back looking at wine and food, this time finishing off our current look by examining various red meats and pork with wine. And finally this week, the wine challenge is a mystery wine region. So let's see how you get on with this. Our region is a leading Spanish region and first to gain DOCA status. That's higher than DOC. It's sheltered in the northwest of the Cantabrian Mountains, which protect it from the Atlantic winds that bring rain to the Basque coast immediately to the north. However, the region stretches 75 miles from northwest to southeast, making it difficult to generalize about the climate. That's the start of the mystery region this week. I'll give you more clues after the news, which is coming up next with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. Britain's biggest wine company, Direct Wines, has celebrated its 40th year with a birthday bash for 150 guests at Chateau Talbot in Bordeaux. The company is privately owned by Tony Lathwaite and his wife Barbara, and is probably best known to British wine drinkers through the Sunday Times Wine Club, which the Lathwaites have operated since 1973. This year, the company expects to turn over £350 million, selling wine through various wine clubs in the UK, the US, Germany, Switzerland and Australia. They operate from a large warehouse in Thiel, Berkshire, and employ about 1,000 people globally. Most recently, they've secured deals with the Wall Street Journal in the US and Die Welt in Germany, and a similar deal is on its way in Hong Kong.
Congratulations to Lathwaites. They truly do dominate the mail order business. Brands include Virgin Wines and Avery's, which they've both bought out recently. What's next, Jane?
Well, famous French winemaker Jean Hugel has died in France aged 84. Known as Johnny in the wine trade, he was a leading producer in the northeastern province of Alsace and credited with rebuilding the Alsatian wine trade after World War II. The company, Hugel & Fee, was established in 1639, but since 1997 has been run by his three nephews. Jean leaves behind his wife Simone and their two daughters.
Jean is a great Alsace wine man. Shame to see him go. What's next, Jane?
Wine producers in New York are facing reduced crops due to late spring frosts that hit the Lake Erie Grape Belt last month. Temperatures dropped into the mid-20s Fahrenheit, and it's estimated the overall crop loss will be between 10 to 20%. The grape varieties affected were primarily Concord and Niagara. The region extends across three states, from western New York through to Erie Country in northeast Pennsylvania and to Geneva in the east of Ohio. That's it from me this week, but don't forget, you can check out these stories at our website 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. For more information on New York wine region, we're talking with Jim Treesize after the spotlight. This week we're talking about matching wines to red meats and pork. Red meat, red wine, that's always been the cry. But why? Let's have a look at red meat. It usually contains heavy, often fatty, full of protein, and having a real meaty taste, obviously. Being heavy means that you need to match the weight of the food with the weight of the wine. This leads to heavier styles of wine, which red wines easily attain. But within meaty dishes, there's a range of weights. Heavier casseroles, for example, or rare steak are two extremes. Lamb, with its strong flavours, need a powerful wide to avoid being overwhelmed. So rich, heavy wines, such as a Barossa Shiraz, will go quite well with casserole, and Bordeaux match a lighter steak. Bordeaux and those sort of wines, which are quite tannic, often go quite well with rare meats because the meat is high in proteins, especially the blood in rare meat, and proteins soften tannins. Now, the way that the meat softens tannins is that the proteins bind to the tannin molecules, which means that the tannins don't interact with our mouth or making the wines perceived to be less dry or less tannic. Now, pork. With its fulsome flavours, they often need a full-bodied white wine or a light or even medium-bodied red. Viogniers and oaky Chardonnays are a good place to start with whites, and for reds, think cool to medium climates. Now that ends this week's current look at wine and food matching. Next week, we're looking at the results of our poll question. Would you buy an expensive wine in a lightweight bottle? We asked this poll about 2 years ago, and next week we see if attitudes have changed. If you want to have your say, go to 3050.co.uk, click on the podcast link, and the question is on the right-hand side. Just as an aside, we're getting ready to send out our newsletter in the next week or so, and if you don't receive it, you may want to receive it. So while you're on the site, do go to the Contact Us tab and give us your details. Make sure you select newsletter so we don't bother you about running a wine tasting with us or anything like that. Right, next up we have the grape region. So our leading Spanish wine region makes both red wines and whites, and only certain grapes are permitted for classified wines. Most wines are blends. Tempranillo is probably the most widely planted and produces the best wines grown on clay and limestone slopes, while Grenache is the focus of the hotter and sometimes drought-ridden regions. Grenache or Grenache is often used to add body to Tempranillo, which can taste thin in the cooler regions. Now, the vineyards in our mystery region tend to be small, and winemaking varies from traditional to ultra-modern. In addition to red wines, rosé is made and white wines made from Viura, as well as cava being allowed to make in this region. For those of you who have been listening to the show, you may know we've actually covered this region in one of our early podcasts. So see how you get on with that. Well, next we have our interview with Jim Treesize from New York about viticulture, grapes and wines in the New York wine region. Hi, I'm here with Jim Treesize. How are you, Jim?
I'm just terrific, thanks.
Excellent. You're the president of the New York Grape and Vine, is that right?
New York Wine and Grape Foundation, yes.
What is that you guys do?
Well, we represent all New York grape growers and wineries and even grape juice producers, and all means 260 wineries in New York State, over 1,000 vineyards, and some large grape juice producers like Welch's that's known around the world.
Sure, I drink Welch's not every day, but pretty much.
Well, then your heart is beating very well.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. Excellent. So what is the New York viticulture scene like?
It's very interesting. New York is actually one of the oldest but newest wine regions in the United States. Obviously, we're one of the oldest regions because the Europeans, you know, came to our side of the continent. And actually, it was 400 years ago that Henry Hudson from England sailed out of Amsterdam and discovered the Hudson River, which is now one of the wine regions that we have. Base of the Hudson River is New York City, which, of course, flows into the Atlantic. If you go north up the Hudson River, you have the Hudson River Valley wine region. That's one of our five wine regions. And then also to the east of that by about 100 miles, 60 kilometers, or I'm sorry, 160 kilometers, is the Long Island region. We're on the tip of Long Island. That's actually the closest region to Europe. And then far away from that to the west is the Finger Lakes region, where most of the wines are made. We have over 100 wineries there and about 80% of our total production. And then further west still, right near Niagara Falls, near Buffalo, is the Niagara Escarpment. And then finally is the Lake Erie region on the southern border of one of the Great Lakes, Lake Erie. So we have five major American viticultural areas, and within those there are four more sub-regions.
Okay, and what are the sub-regions? Long Island's got two.
Long Island has two. One is the North Fork of Long Island. The other is the Hamptons, Long Island, which is the playground of the rich and famous.
Yeah, Sex and the City and
there,
all that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And then in the Finger Lakes region, the largest region, there are two sub-appellations named after two of the lakes, Seneca Lake and Cayuga Lake.
Okay, and then the others, Lake Erie. Lake Erie, I remember from a horror movie somewhere. I don't know why. Well, was it famous in a horror movie?
I'm not sure about that, but it could have been some bad fish or something. But the wines are good.
You talked about the regions. American system's called AVAs, isn't it? What's that for?
Yep, and it stands for American Viticultural Area. So it's a specific region that has certain soil and temperature characteristics.
And are the wines supposed to represent a particular style from there, or is it more an association body? Like in New Zealand, for example, they have a thing called GI, Geographical Indicators.
Right.
Very, very loose, hardly any controls in it. And then you go to maybe the extreme, which is Appellation Control in France, which is very structured and very very rigid. How does the AVAs fit in with that?
We're more like New Zealand's. In other words, the whole idea of the American Viticultural Area, which our federal government administers, is to give consumers information about where the grapes were grown. So that if a bottle of wine has one of those areas on it, let's say Seneca Lake or the Hamptons, Long Island, then at least 85% of those grapes, the grapes in that wine, have to be grown in that particular area. So it's not necessarily stylistic, but it is geographic, so people know exactly where the grapes came from.
All right. And if you get a change in soil types, does it change the AVA, or is it?
No, it doesn't change the AVA at all. I mean, in the Finger Lakes, for example, which were carved out by glaciers, we have soil types, you know, acre by acre. So it's not... it's not something that's consistent across the whole region.
Okay, looking at the maps of the Finger Lakes, you can see where it was probably glaciers, was it, that were coming down? And
yeah, 10,000 years ago, the Pleistocene era. And it was basically these glaciers that came from north to south, and they dug these huge trenches. There were actually 14 lakes altogether.
There's a lot of fingers.
There's a lot of fingers, that's right. That's three hands. And but the wine region itself is around three of the major ones and a couple minor ones, so that Seneca, Keuka, and Cayuga Lakes are the major ones, and Skinny Atlas and Kinesis as well. So the region is larger than the wine region, but it's a great wine region because of the lakes. Without the lakes, the temperature would be too cold for us to grow the grapes.
Sure. Actually, talking about the grapes and the temperature, we tasted some of your wines just before, and they seem to be quite aromatic, cool climate varieties like Riesling, Pinot Gris. So we've got a Sauvignon Blanc in there, but you're also experimenting with Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot as well. So there's some, it seems to be quite a range of grape varieties for different climates.
Yes, it's very eclectic, and actually we do have several climates. I mean, all of New York is certainly considered a cool climate region, but our warmest region and sunniest region is Eastern Long Island. I mean, it's Long Island is literally a long island. It's about 100 miles long that juts out into the Atlantic Ocean, and so it's surrounded by water. So in the winter, when other parts of the state might be cold, the ocean keeps Long Island much warmer, and it has a lot of sun and so forth. So that's where our most common red wines come from. Merlot is one that Long Island specializes in. Now, when you go to the upstate region, the Finger Lakes, which is the largest region, you have the smaller lakes, and they do moderate the temperature, but it is colder there. So that's where we have the aromatic white wines, Riesling in particular, but also Gewürztraminer, Pinot Gris, and others as well.
I imagine you're starting to get a bit of altitude as well, if you've got ex-glaciers up there.
Yes, yes. There is a lot more altitude, obviously, than Long Island. So it's and what's interesting is that the way the glaciers dug out the lakes is they pushed all the rocks and soil from north to south. So the northern end of the lakes, the surrounding land is relatively flat. It's almost Long Island. But as you go to the southern end of the lakes, you get these very steep hillsides because that's where all of the earth was pushed.
Okay, interesting. We talked a wee bit about a couple of grape varieties, but I noticed a list of grapes that are grown in New York State, and it seemed to have pretty much everything in there. It's got all sorts of stuff, you know, Riesling, Sauvignon Blanc, Cabernet Merlot, Cabernet Franc. But then you're into all sorts of weird things like Concord, Civil Blanc, perhaps pretty thing. But you've got other things like Delaware, Niagara. We even tried a wine earlier, but it's not on the list here. Rice. What was that? The
Arcazzatelli. Yes.
Arcazzatelli. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
There seems to be quite a lot of unusual grapes. What's the history of grape varieties in New York State?
Well, it's fascinating. You know, one of the great things about New York City is its diversity. You know, you have populations from all over the world, all kinds of languages, customs, cultures, and so forth. And our wine industry kind of reflects that as well. We have a great diversity of grape varieties, much more so than almost any wine region in the world. And we started out with what we call the Native American varieties, Labrusca. So Concord, like you have in your Waltz's grape juice, Catawba, Niagara. These are very aromatic, fruity wines that a lot of people still really love. But wine connoisseurs rarely, you know, drink them. So
what did you call it? It's Vitis Labrusca?
Vitis Labrusca. Labrusca. Yep. And so those were the ones that grew naturally in upstate New York. And then in the...
Good natural resistance to phloxera as well.
In natural resistance to phloxera, very cold hardy. So you didn't have to worry about a really cold winter. They would always survive the winter.
And were they there when Hudson arrived? Were there wild grapes in New York when...
There were. And in fact, you know, they were... You know, just celebrating because of all the wild grapes growing on the hillsides. The problem was the wild grapes didn't make very good wine. But what it did say is that, you know, you could cultivate grapes in that area. And so they started creating new breeds of grapes. So there was the first wave that was already there, the Concord, Niagara, Delaware, the Labrusca varieties. And then the French, in response to the phylloxera epidemic, they created all the hybrids,
yep,
like Sauvignon Blanc and Vidal and Rayon d'Or and so forth. And those were imported to New York. So that was the second wave. And what they did is they combined the hardiness of American vines with the taste characteristics of European wines. And then finally, a couple of Europeans, a Frenchman, Charles Fournier, rather, and a Russian, Dr. Constantine Frank, they brought the Vitis vinifera, the European wines, to New York amidst a lot of skepticism. People said, no, you cannot grow these here. It's too cold. And Dr. Frank said, wait a minute, I was growing these in the Ukraine. It's cold there as well. And so if I can do it there, I can do it here. And the two of them proved that you could grow great Rieslings and even Cabernet Sauvignon in their climate.
I had a decent Merlot early. Yeah, I thought that was very good.
If you do it right, you know, there are certain cultural practices in the vineyard that you have to do for them to survive the winter. But
do you have to rake soil over the roots?
That's exactly right. You have to cover the roots every year. So it's more labor intensive. But the thing is, it can be done. And especially with varieties like Riesling, the aromatic whites, the region is just perfect for it. And so now we've become famous for it.
The Rieslings, I thought, when we tasted them were, whilst we didn't taste meat, I think it was only about three or four Rieslings, but they did have a real stone fruit characteristic, which to me implies that it is quite warm, you know, even more warm than, you know, the absolute extreme of what Riesling needs.
Yeah. Our harvest seasons are almost always as wonderful. You know, it's the end of summer, so the nights are getting cooler, which is great for the flavor. But there are warm, sunny days, and so the ripening, you know, happens very, very quickly. And you do get, you know, really great ripeness. And so you have a nice balance of the sugary acid and pH and Rieslings that are winning gold medals all over the world.
What style? Because when we tasted the Riesling and the Pinot Gris and the aromatics, there seemed to be a range of styles from quite dry through to quite sweet. In fact, we even had a late harvest Vidal earlier. But what's the favorite style and where are the wines sold?
The favorite style at this point is, in terms of Riesling, would be an off-dry style. Not totally bone dry, not sweet, but somewhere in between. Have a little bit of, you know, a lot more aroma and so forth. But we also have a lot of, you know, the traditional, the drier wines, the Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blancs, and others as well, especially from Long Island. And the reds, the Merlot is the one that we make the most of. Cabernet Franc has a lot of possibility as well. And we have all of the other varieties that we started with long ago. Where are they sold? Predominantly at the wineries themselves, and therefore in the regions, in the tasting rooms. And we get over 4 million visitors a year to the wineries in New York State. It's one of the largest areas in terms of visitation. And so for the wineries, the best thing they can do is sell directly to the customer. And so probably 75% of the wine of the small wineries is sold directly to the customer in the tasting room. The rest of it, by and large, is either within the region or certainly within New York State. So we do have a small export program, which is why we're here. And this is a great, great show that we always participate in.
We're at the London International Wine Fair at the moment.
But most of the wines are sold within New York State.
Okay. Do you export to other states? Because I think it's probably easier to export to the UK than it would be to another American state.
You're right. You know, we're still suffering from the legacy of prohibition, so that the United States is actually 50 different countries when it comes to selling wine. It's preposterous and it's shameful that was the way our government left it. But no, it is easier to export to the UK than it is to Pennsylvania, which is just south of us. So there are a few wineries that have enough production and staff that they can fill out all the paperwork and pay the taxes. But we actually look to export markets sooner than we look to other states.
How much wine is produced in New York bottles, or do you have a rough idea?
Yeah, about 200 million bottles a year are produced in New York. No, it is. We have good production. Obviously, in the United States, California is in a league of its own. 90% of total production. Washington State is second to California, but very much on a par with New York, and we're very much pretty much equal to Washington.
What wineries do you recommend I should keep an eye out for from New York?
Well, one of the most famous that has good wines across the board and a quantity of production that's sufficient that they, you know, they're distributed pretty well, it's called Dr. Constantine Frank, Dr. Frank. And he was the Russian viticulturist who showed you could, you know, grow Riesling and Cabernet Sauvignon in upstate New York. So that's a label that you can always count on that has reasonably good distribution. Others include Anthony Road Winery, Lakewood Vineyards, and Chateau Lafayette Renault, Wagner. So there are a handful. There are 5 to 10 that not only can you count on, but they have adequate distribution.
Okay then, Jim. I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
The range of wines was excellent, and the wines I tasted were all very good. It's a shame that they're so niche and not really in the UK market at the moment. I had a look for the New York wines recommended by Jim. I couldn't find a cellar for Dr. Constantine Frank in the UK. The closest importer I could find was in Sweden. Anthony Road Winery, Lakewood Vineyards, and Chateau Lafite Renault do not seem to export wines out of the UK, according to their websites, and I couldn't find any importer in my Harper's Wine & Spirit directory. I did find an importer for a New York wine called Beadle, which is ranked number 3 in North American Atlantic wines, according to Tom Stevenson's wine report. If you're after a New York wine, then you can get it from the World Wine Web, although their website was down when I went to check it out. The only wine I knew I could definitely buy was a wine from Mills Bitter Wines in Newbury called Corrie Creek Chardonnay from Long Island for about £20. I haven't tried it, and I haven't seen any recommendations for that wine, but that's the only one I could find for sure. As I said, the wines were good, and I suspect, looking at many New York wine websites, meeting local markets and some interstate shipping is pretty much their lot. Next week, we're on the other side of America looking at wines from Oregon, where they're certainly a lot more common in the UK. But before we finish up, how did you get on with our mystery region? It was Rioja. Here are the clues again. Rioja is the leading Spanish wine region and the first to gain DOCA status, which is higher than DOC. It's named after the Rio, which is river, and Oca, a tribute to the river Ebro, along which the vineyards are planted. It's sheltered to the north and west by the Cantabrian Mountains, which protect it from the Atlantic winds that bring rain to the Basque coast immediately to the north. However, the region stretches 17.5 miles from northwest to southeast, making it difficult to generalize about the climate. It's divided into three zones, Rioja Alta, Rioja Alvisa, and Rioja Baja. Only certain grapes are permitted for the classified wines, and most Riojas are a blend of Tempranillo, which is probably the most widely planted and produces the best wines grown on clay and limestone slopes around Rioja Alta and Alvisa, while Grenache is the focus of the hotter and sometimes drought-ridden Rioja Baja, and often used to add body to Tempranillo, which can taste thin in cooler vintages. Vineyards in Rioja tend to be small, and winemaking varies from traditional to ultra-modern. Red wines, rosé, and white wines can be made, as well as sparkling wines. That pretty much ends the show. Just one more thing to say, the quote, and then we're all done. This time it's from Bernard Shaw about being a teetotal. I'm only a beer teetotal, not a champagne teetotal. I don't like beer. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.